I appreciate everybody coming this early. I'm surprised that this many people would show up this early to hear anything other than, you know, why Sarah Palin is resigning. My theory is that her affair with Mark Sanford is about to be disclosed. Actually, if you really want to know why I think she resigned, I don't know if anybody cares, but under Alaska law, you cannot make any money other than being governor, outside income. And if you've got a multi-million dollar book contract about to be signed, you can't accept that contract if you're governor. That probably would be my theory, but I don't really know. In any event, I appreciate everybody's coming this morning. I just want to ask a couple questions. How many people know why we celebrate the 4th of July? And let me ask the question this way. How many people think that on the 4th of July, the Declaration of Independence was actually signed on that date? Okay. How many people think that the Continental Congress decided to free itself from Britain on that date? They voted to free themselves or be independent on that date. How many people think it was the date that we actually, the Declaration of Independence text was agreed to? Nobody knows. All right. What actually happened was July the 2nd was the date that the Declaration of Independence, the Continental Congress decided to vote for independence on July the 2nd. It was a close vote. Actually, it was 12 states for it. One, New York, abstained. They didn't have the support. They actually were going to have the vote on July the 1st, but they didn't even have 13 states then that were willing to agree to do it. They had about 9, and they had to round up some votes, and they voted on the 2nd. On the 4th, they actually agreed to the text of the Declaration of Independence, which I'll talk about in a moment. But it wasn't actually signed until August the 2nd, more or less. So we actually decide to honor the July the 4th date for a lot of complicated historical reasons. And it's interesting, when you think about the history of our country, most countries have their national day when the day the country was created. Our country, you say, could be created on the day that our Constitution was agreed to, but that was much later. The Constitution wasn't actually ratified until 1790. It was drafted in 1787 and actually ratified finally by 1790, but we don't celebrate the beginning of the country when the Constitution was actually signed. For some reason, we celebrate it when the Declaration of Independence text was agreed to. And why is that? Well, it's a lot of unusual reasons. When John Adams wrote to his wife, Abigail Adams, he wrote to her on July the 2nd. He said that July the 2nd would be the date that everybody remembers in the United States for the rest of the history of the country, because that was the day when the Continental Congress actually agreed that they were going to separate from England. But it turned out that July the 2nd wasn't the date. It was July the 4th, and probably for historical reasons that are hard to understand. But on the following year, when the Continental Congress was meeting, when July the 2nd rolled around, they forgot about it. They forgot about the celebration. And so they remembered. And so July the 4th happened to be a Saturday, and they decided to have a dinner. And so the next year, George Washington decided, but the war was still going on, the next July the 4th, George Washington, to celebrate the July the 4th, gave his troops a double amount of rum that day to celebrate it. And then subsequently, the July 4th kind of took hold, even though it wasn't the date that anything actually happened. All they agreed to do was to agree on the text of the Declaration of Independence. The Declaration of Independence was really more or less a propaganda document. It didn't have any legal force. It really just gave the American people the reasons why the Continental Congress thought it was important to separate from England. And it wasn't really, for many years, until it became an official holiday in the United States. And it really didn't become an official holiday until after the Civil War. Congress didn't say until 1870, this is going to be an official holiday. But Congress said, you and federal employees can take off this day if you want, but you don't get paid. So it was a holiday, but not a paid holiday. Not until 1938 did our Congress actually say, it's an official holiday of the United States, and federal employees can have the day off, and they get paid. Now, the first state that actually agreed to make it a holiday was Massachusetts, which was in about 1790. So many states agreed to celebrate the 4th of July, but it really wasn't the federal government until much later that it actually became an official holiday. And now the 4th of July really has rolled up many different things. It's not just so much the Declaration of Independence. It's really our national day. It's a celebration of our freedoms, our Constitution. We've kind of rolled everything into one day. It's a kind of day of patriotism. And so it's really not so much the day that the Declaration of Independence text was agreed to. The Declaration of Independence text is very interesting. It is when it was agreed to, when it was written, I'll go through this a little bit more in detail in a moment, but when it was agreed to, most people did not think it was that significant. The significant thing was what happened on July the 2nd. The text was something that was worked out. It was written by Thomas Jefferson, mostly, but it changed dramatically in Congress, and Congress actually changed about 25% or deleted about 25% of what he wrote. And most of their effort was to figure out what we should say about why the Declaration of Independence, why we were freeing ourselves from Britain. It wasn't about the thing that has become so famous in the Declaration of Independence. The Declaration of Independence mostly is about what King George did wrong. That's what the delegates spent most of their time in the Continental Congress debating. Today, nobody cares about that. In fact, nobody even focuses on that. The Declaration of Independence, in fact, for 20 years, 30 years, 40 years after it was signed, was something that was not that significant in terms of people in America taking that much time on it or paying that much attention to it, because they'd already won the war and they didn't care about why King George was had done things wrong. But it was a little bit of the preamble that became so famous, and that preamble now has become one sentence of it, become one of the most famous sentences in the history of the English language. And it's one that everybody remembers, and it's really become a symbol of our country. And some people say it's poetry. Some people say it's really what our country's all about. And it basically is this: we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That is, in the view of many people, the embodiment of what America is all about. Now, ironically, Lincoln thought that was the spirit of the whole country, and he later used that as the justification for the Emancipation Proclamation and other things. But when Jefferson wrote that, it was ironic when he wrote that all men are created equal. In fact, he didn't really believe all men were created equal. As many people know, he owned 60 slaves at the time that he wrote the Declaration of Independence. He had 4 slaves with him up in Philadelphia when he wrote it. He had written many times earlier that blacks and whites could not live together. He thought that maybe slavery was wrong, but he didn't necessarily believe that they could live together if the slaves were freed. Now, many people know when somebody says to you, it's self-evident, that means it's not self-evident. When somebody says to you, it's not about the money, it is about the money. And so when it's, and actually, Jefferson didn't actually write it was self-evident. He wrote, it is sacred and undeniable. It was in the drafting committee that Benjamin Franklin said, well, why do we need 3 words? We can use 1. He said, let's make it is self-evident. But it really wasn't self-evident that all men are created equal. Now, how did I get interested in this? Let me just give you a little background and why I think the Declaration of Independence is so important, even though it's really only 1 or 2 sentences in it now that's really relevant. Many times, many people here probably have had things in their lives happen that you didn't expect to happen, and it just went on by serendipity. Something changed in your life because of something that you hadn't anticipated. One day, I was flying back to the United States from somewhere, and I was going through papers, and I saw that I had been invited to go to a reception in New York. And the reception in New York was a reception to promote the sale of the Magna Carta. It turned out that the Magna Carta, a copy of the Magna Carta, was being sold by Sotheby's, and somebody who knew me invited me to the reception, and it was fortuitous that I happened to be able to go to New York that night. And with about 5 minutes to go before the Sotheby's reception was to close, I walked in, I ran into, by luck, the woman who was in charge of the sale. She explained to me that Ross Perot had bought this document in 1982. It was the only copy in private hands. It had been on display at the archives for a number of years, and he was putting it up for sale to take the proceeds and give it to Iraqi war veterans for their medical treatment. So there was no constraint by Ross Perot on what the document was, what the proceeds were, where the document could go. And so it was thought at the time that somebody from Saudi Arabia or Russia or the Far East would buy the only copy in American hands. And the Magna Carta was a document that inspired Thomas Jefferson when he wrote the Declaration of Independence. It inspired Abraham Lincoln when he drafted the Emancipation Proclamation. And I thought it was unfortunate that we'd probably lose the one copy in our country. But never having been to an auction in my life, I didn't really anticipate I'd go to the auction. But then I realized the next day I happened to be in New York. And so I just, that night I decided I was going to buy this and keep it in our country. And so I went there not really knowing that I was going to win, but hoping that I would. And it turned out that my flight was delayed to get back to New York the next day. And so with about 5 minutes to go, I got out of the taxi cab and started running to the Sotheby's auction. I got in there. I saw the same woman. And she said, okay, the auction's going to start in about 2 minutes. Go into this little room. And I said, well, I want to be where the auction is. I want to be down there, hold my hand up and all that. She said, no, we don't have time for that. You didn't get registered the right way. Go in this little room. We'll put you on a telephone, and you can bid. So I figured if I argued with her, I would miss the auction. So I go in a little room. And I'd never been to Sotheby's to buy anything before. And so I pick up a telephone, and the guy says, okay, the Magna Carta, let's start. You know, 1 million, 2 million, they start. So I kept, I got into the flow of it, and I finally won. I think the bid was around $19 million, and with commission was about $21 million. And I kept bidding, and, expecting him to say another bid, and he said, sold. I said, uh-oh. So I actually bought this thing. So they came up to me and said, okay, who are you? Because they said there's about 100 press people out there who want to know who bought this thing. And you can slip out the side door and nobody will know. I said, no, I want to say that I want to give it to the American to the archives, because I think it's important that we have a copy in our country. There are only 17 copies in the world. 15 of them reside in British institutions. They're never going to be sold. One was sold in 1962 for $10,000 to the Australian government, and it's now displayed in the Australian Parliament. And then there is this copy, and it's the only one in private hands. And it's now on display at the National Archives. And as I began to talk about it in front of the press that day, I realized that it had much more significance than even I had thought. It really had been the basis for much of what was done in the Revolutionary War, the idea that taxation without representation. Many of the key rights in the Magna Carta are really embodied in our Constitution, our Bill of Rights, our Declaration of Independence. And so when I left that day, I went to a dinner party hosted by Chuck Prince, who was then the head of Citicorp. And I sat down. I said, I'm sorry, I'm late. I just bought a copy of the Magna Carta. And so actually when it was in the newspaper the next day, he called me up and said, I apologize. I thought you were making a joke. I didn't know you actually bought it. That night, I called my wife, and I said, I just bought a copy of the Magna Carta. And she said, what? And, you don't want to tell people in advance you're going to buy a copy of the Magna Carta, because they'll think you're crazy. And so I didn't actually tell anybody. I did tell my kids that night, and they said, well, does this mean we inherit less money? Because, so they had their mind on the right thing, I guess. But actually, it is about the money. Most people probably don't know what the Magna Carta really is. And let me just describe it for a moment. Many of you who all went to school probably heard it's 1215, King John, Runnymede, and that's about all you probably know. Let me describe what actually happened. In those days, in the 1200s, England was really England and France were kind of part of the same country, really. And there was a king, King John. And King John was trying to recover some of the land he had lost in France. And he was actually a Frenchman. He had grown up in France, but he was then the king of England. And to finance these wars, he needed money. And so he would keep getting the money from the barons. And eventually, they got tired of financing these wars. And so they began to revolt. And they took over the city of London. And he recognized that he was in trouble. So he agreed to sit down with about 100 of them at Runnymede, which is outside of London. And he basically agreed to a peace agreement, a settlement, under which he agreed that he would give them certain rights. There were 63 provisions in the original 2,500-word written in Latin, Magna Carta, written in 1215. And there were 63 provisions, many of which were very bizarre, but they basically gave certain rights to the noblemen. They were things like habeas corpus, right to a jury by your peers, trial by jury of your peers. If any property was taken, it had to be compensated for. You couldn't... punishment had to be proportionate to the crime and so forth. And also, people shouldn't be taxed without being represented. And there were a couple provisions in there which actually said, and if you owed money to Jews, you don't have to pay it. This is hard to believe. Now, actually, later, in subsequent versions of the Magna Carta, that was taken out. And I couldn't say, I'm trying to figure myself, why did they start to like Jews a little bit better later on? Well, the answer was they kicked all the Jews out of England in 1270, so they didn't have to worry about that provision later. But actually in 1215, so anyway, King John signs this reluctantly, and then he goes about his way. And then all of a sudden he realizes that he's given away too much, because he had basically given away the authority to be king, because if had he done certain things, a committee of 25 barons could overrule him. And as a result, the Pope, who really then technically overruled or ruled England, said to King John, I'm going to excommunicate you if you agree to this and you stand by it, because if you stand by this, what you've really done is you've said that the highest authority in the land is not God, and it's not a deity, and it's not the king, it's some nobleman, and we can't agree to that. You know, the church is the highest authority. So King John, 2 weeks later, said, I'm walking away from the treaty, from Magna Carta. So it lasted for about 2 or 3 weeks, and then the noblemen revolted, and they had a war, and in the middle of the war, King John was crossing a river, he fell into it, got dysentery eventually, died. So then his son became the king, King Henry, but he was only 9 years old. And so the noblemen were going to revolt again and take over and throw this king away, throw him over, but the regents around this young 9-year-old king said, we'll agree to anything you noblemen want. So they agreed to another Magna Carta, and was signed in 1225, and they agreed to do another one in 1226, and so forth. And basically, for a number of years, it was England had peace, and the king kind of ruled. He didn't have all the rights he had before, but there was peace. And then he died, and his son took over. And his son was King Edward III. And when his son took over, he had the same problem that his grandfather had. He needed to recover some of his lands in England, in France, and so he began to tax the noblemen for this, and they began to be upset again. And once again, they said, we're not going to pay these taxes. And so while he was in the middle of a war, he agreed to something called the 1297 version of the Magna Carta. And that basically said not only all the things before, except the provision about the Jews, they didn't need that anymore, but it also said for sure, no taxation without representation, and the king could not get money from these noblemen without there being represented any discussions about it. And he agreed to that. And the novel thing about the 1297 version is that went on the laws of the books of England. The 1215 version really was ignored and really didn't really have any real long-term impact on England's laws. But the 1297 version was written into the laws of England as an official law of England, and therefore it had much more historical impact than the 1215 version. The 1297 version is the version that I actually bought. And you might say, well, why are there so few of these versions around? Why, after all these years, are there only 17? Well, this is the answer. There were 40 counties in England in those days, effectively counties, and every time a Magna Carta was signed, 1215, 1225, 1297, each of the counties would get one, so they would know what the law of the land was and what had been agreed to. But they were written on parchment, and parchment was animal skin, and mice and rats like to eat animal skin, and over a 700-year period of time, the filing system wasn't so wonderful, and as a result, most of them were decimated. Now, the version that I bought, which what Ross Perot had earlier bought, had been in one family's possession for 500 years. 500 years they had it. Now, it wasn't clear how they got it, but they did get it. They were a noble family, and they were land rich but cash poor. And so to pay taxes in the early 1980s, they had to sell it. They sold it to Ross Perot for about $1.25 million. And you might say to yourself, well, why over all these years did the United States not get a Magna Carta earlier? Well, during the World War II, it was thought by the British Ministry of Defense, or War, that it'd be a good idea to maybe give the Magna Carta to the United States, or a copy of it, because we wanted to get them in the war, and maybe this would be a nice inducement. Some people would call it a bribe. And so it was looked very carefully at whether we should give it to the United, they should give it to the United States. And in fact, the problem was that the British government itself only owns two versions of the 1215 version. One of them is a pretty good copy. One was completely burned. It has nothing on it that you can read. So Winston Churchill said, well, if we give them the burned copy, what is that? There's nothing to see. If we give them the good copy, we don't have a copy of the 1215 version in our country anymore. So ultimately, they decided not to give them one. One was lent for the 1939 World's Fair. Ultimately, it was stored in Fort Knox during the World War II, and ultimately it went back to England. When Queen Elizabeth was coming over for the bicentennial celebration, the same question arose, why don't we give a copy of the Magna Carta to the United States? But again, they had the same problem. The government of England doesn't actually own any that they can give away, so we actually never got one given by England, and therefore that's why we don't really own one. We do own one now, and I believe that there's not likely to be another one coming into private hands because all of them are owned by British institutions, and it'd be unlikely the British Museum or Archives would sell them. Now, fast forward to the Revolutionary War period. Most people probably don't remember this, but there was no great desire on the part of our country to actually break away from England. The country, you know, basically, we had 13 separate colonies, and each of these colonies dealt directly with England. The colonies didn't deal with each other. The colonies had more relationships with England than they had with each other. In fact, when the first Continental Congress was held, that was the first time that most people who were members of the Continental Congress had ever been to Philadelphia. There were 56 people in the Continental Congress. Very few of them had actually ever been to Philadelphia. John Adams had never been to Philadelphia when he went to the Continental Congress. And more people had been to London than had been to Philadelphia. London was then a city of about 500,000 people. The biggest city in the United States was Philadelphia. It had 30,000 people. That was the biggest city. And that's why they had the Continental Congress there. And over a period of time, what really led to the Revolutionary War, for people who don't remember their history, is that there was something called the French and Indian War of about 7 years, and the British spent a lot of time and money winning that war and securing borders for the United States, or for the colonies, and it cost a lot of money, and they had to keep troops in the United States. So for the first time ever, they decided to impose taxes on the United States. Before, the colonies hadn't really paid any taxes. They literally gave benefits to England by commercial trade, and the benefits to England were the trade. It wasn't taxes. So England imposed some taxes. They were not very popular, needless to say, without going through the whole history of the various taxes that were imposed and taken off and so forth. It was generally agreed that it would be not a good idea to keep imposing these taxes, and eventually England relieved a lot of them, but there began to be some hard feeling about other issues, and ultimately the members of the Continental Congress came together to try to figure out how they could get England to leave them alone a bit and let them run the colonies the way they wanted to, and there were some taxes that were about to be imposed again, and an effort was made to keep England from imposing more taxes and doing more things to control the colonies. And ultimately, it was agreed that it wasn't likely to work. So the Second Continental Congress was basically put together to get ready to declare independence. Now, it wasn't a time where many people thought there was likely to be independence. Most people in the United States were quite happy the way it was. Declaring independence was something most people hadn't really thought would ever happen, because these people in the United States were then, there was about 2.5 million people in the United States. They had, you know, their relatives were all from England. That's where many people had been educated there. Most of the upper-class people had gone to England for education. Their relatives were there. That's where they did business. So the idea of breaking away wasn't such a common thing. But eventually it was concluded that they couldn't make the Parliament agree to the idea that the country should have certain rights. And this is where the rub came in. When each of the colonies was set up, they were set up under a charter. And the charter said that you have the same rights as British citizens. Well, those British citizens thought they had the rights of the Magna Carta, certain rights of no taxation without representation and so forth. Well, the Parliament was saying, no, you are members of the colonies, and the colonies ignore the Charter. You don't have the right as the same citizen. You don't have the rights of the citizens of England. You don't have those rights. You're just members of the colonies. The colonies said, we have these charters that say we have the same rights, and that was really the problem. The Parliament didn't really recognize the rights of the colonial citizens, and so the colonies got together, they petitioned the king, saying, look, the Parliament only applies to England. You don't really rule us. We're loyal to the king. And the king was King George III. Almost everybody's heard of him by now. He was thought to be a little unusual. He was actually somebody who ruled 40 years after the Revolutionary War. He did have some mental problems that were fairly serious, but he wasn't completely out of it. And he basically took the view that he was going to support the Parliament, and he did not want to get into whether or not the rights of the Magna Carta, the rights of taxation or anything, were things to be taken away from Parliament. So he absolved himself from it. And at that point, John Adams, who was leading the revolutionary effort and to declare independence in the Second Continental Congress, he got the Congress to pass a resolution which said that each of the states should reconstitute themselves, not as colonies of England, but have a new charter. And each of the states in May was importuned by the Second Continental Congress to adopt a new, in effect, formation agreement for their colony to put a new government in place. And once that was agreed to by the Second Continental Congress, it was clear that each colony would probably begin a new government that wasn't loyal to England, and then probably there would be independence. And then somebody from Virginia, Richard Henry Lee, introduced in early June a resolution that said we should be independent. And that was something that was very novel, and none of the delegates to the Continental Congress had authority to agree to that, because they had to get instructions from their from their local legislatures, and so they adjourned the Second Continental Congress in early June, so everybody could go back and get authority to vote for this resolution by Richard Henry Lee of Virginia. During that period of time, it was thought that probably the resolution would be agreed to, and so they would like to have some kind of declaration that they could tell the public in England why it was that we were going to break away. So they appointed a committee of five people to draft a declaration. The committee consisted of Robert Livingston of New York, not that well known, Roger Sherman of Connecticut, not that well known, and three other people, pretty well known, John Adams, Benjamin Franklin, and Thomas Jefferson. Thomas Jefferson was only 33 years old. He was one of the youngest members of the Continental Congress. The oldest was Benjamin Franklin, who was then 70. And how would you like to be on a committee like that? You know, it's a pretty imposing committee. Well, Thomas Jefferson was picked not because he was a very impressive or well-known figure. He was actually not that well-known. He was a person who was not a very good speaker. In fact, in the Second Continental Congress, he never actually said a single word. He never was a person who was comfortable making speeches. In his 8 years as president, he never made a single speech. He was a person who was very comfortable writing. He wrote about 20,000 letters in his lifetime, 14,000 of which survive. But he was very comfortable sitting alone, writing, and so he was given the task of being the draftsman. Now, people later said, well, why did not John Adams, who was much better known and probably more ardent of a revolutionary figure, why didn't he draft it? And he said later that he thought that Jefferson was 10 times a better writer, that Jefferson wasn't as obnoxious as he was, Adams, didn't have as many enemies, and was better to have somebody from Virginia writing this, not somebody from Massachusetts, because Massachusetts was seen as too much in favor of independence, and Virginia was seen as maybe not quite as pro-independence. And therefore, Jefferson was given the task, and he was given basically 17 days to do it. But during the day, he had to attend the Continental Congress, so he couldn't really write during the day. And at night, he had some other things he was doing, so he really wrote the whole Declaration of Independence in about 4 days, the latter 4 days. And he had a private room he had rented. He had his slaves. He had four slaves with him who were attending to his needs. He had a little writing desk that he had written, which is now in the Smithsonian. And he basically wrote this out without any books. He claimed he never had any single books with him. And he didn't have any references to anything. He just kind of did it basically on memory. Now, later people have accused him of not saying anything original in the Declaration of Independence. Not a single thing in there is original. He later said, well, I wasn't deciding to come up with something new. It wasn't my task. I was trying to reflect the American mind. And today, some of what is in there would be called plagiarism. Because if you look at some other documents that were around at that time, particularly something written in the Virginia Constitution by George Mason, it looks as if it's exactly word for word almost what Jefferson wrote. But plagiarism wasn't a concept that really existed in those days. And Jefferson basically said, I really wasn't trying to be original. Well, when he turned in his draft to Benjamin Franklin, who was 70, had gout, really wasn't that involved, he just made a couple changes because he knew that Jefferson was very sensitive to any editing. And he knew that Jefferson was a guy that would be upset if he was edited very much. So he made a couple changes. One I mentioned, Jefferson had written sacred and undeniable, and Franklin wrote in self-evident. And then he gave a copy as well to Adams. Adams said he made hardly any changes because he also knew that Jefferson was very temperamental and didn't want to upset him. And so ultimately, a draft was presented back to the Continental Congress, and they put it on hold until the vote occurred. The vote was taken on July 1st. They began a vote on whether to declare independence or not, and they didn't have the votes. 9 states voted for it. 3 weren't in favor of, one abstained. And so they then had to go out and get the votes, and they basically waited till the next day. And at the end of July the 2nd, they had the votes. 12 states in favor of it. 1 state, New York, abstained. They didn't have the authority. Later, they agreed to it subsequently. And so then on July the 3rd, they took up the Declaration of Independence, the text of it. And on the text of it, Jefferson sat there and didn't say a single word. He didn't defend his writings. He later said that it was mangled. He thought that roughly 25% of what he had written was destroyed by, or what he would say destroyed, by the Continental Congress, particularly 2 provisions that he cared very much about. He had a provision in there saying that King George had forced slavery and the slave trades on the states, and that was one of his offenses. But he also said that King George, which was not quite true. Many of the delegates felt it was a little unfair to blame King George for forcing slavery on the states because it had started a long time before. And Jefferson also said in there that King George had importuned the slaves to revolt. Well, you know, if you were against slavery, why would you be against the slaves revolting? So it was a little inconsistent, but that was taken out. Georgia didn't want, and South Carolina didn't want any mention of slavery, and there is no mention of slavery in the Declaration of Independence. There's no mention of slavery in the Constitution. There was another provision in there saying that, in effect, we have relationships with people in England. We're going to have to sever these relationships, and while they've been long personal relationships, we should recognize that these people in England who are our relatives, they're now our enemies. That was taken out as well. It was so much destroyed in Jefferson's view that Jefferson never acknowledged that he wrote the Declaration of Independence for about 10 years. He was so embarrassed with the way it had been changed, and many of you may have seen something like this happen in your life. He then, while these changes were being made, and when they were finally made, he then wrote to his best friend saying, here is the version that I wrote. Here's what the Continental Congress did. Don't you think my version's better? But he was very upset. In fact, it wasn't known that he was the main author of it until much later. Ultimately, it was agreed to in the text on July the 4th. And so then what happened? Well, there was a handwritten version that they had agreed to, but what were they going to show people? Well, they went to a printer that night, July the 4th, and said to this printer, his name was John Dunlap, can you print 200 copies of this text we've just agreed to? And he did. It was called a broadside. It was printed in the newspaper. He printed up 200 copies, and they would be distributed around the United States so people would know what was agreed to. It was finally printed up. One copy was sent to George Washington, who read it to the troops on July the 8th. Another copy was sent to other to England and to their representatives to let them know. The English, when they finally got it, they wrote, they hired somebody to write a pamphlet saying, well, what are these Americans talking about? How can they say all men are created equal? They have slaves. They pointed out the very fallacy that I mentioned earlier. In any event, there were about 200 of these copies floated around and printed, and about 25 of them now survive in the United States. One was just discovered a couple days ago that Britain actually had one in its library. But what was actually signed? All that was printed by John Dunlap was something on print. Nothing was signed. Well, they got a person who was a calligrapher, and he ultimately wrote out something that looks like that. And then around August the 2nd, the delegates to the Continental Congress came back, and they signed it. Most of them signed it around August the 2nd. Some signed it subsequently. And then that copy, the original copy that was signed, is now in the archives. However, it was given initially to the State Department to be the holder of it, and the State Department wasn't set up to hold documents in those days, and when the War of 1812 came, they had to rush it out of Washington because it would have been destroyed. At one point, it was put back on display in Washington in the Patent Bureau for about 40 years, right in front of all the sunlight and everything. People could look at it. Well, it faded. And in 1820, John Quincy Adams, the Secretary of State, who then had possession of it, said, it's faded so much, we have to preserve it. So he hired a man named William Stone, and he was told to come in and make a copy that we could keep forever, so everybody would know what the original copy looked like. So he got a kind of wet cloth, and he put it on the original copy, and he took some of the ink off of it over a long process. Unfortunately, a lot of the ink that was on the original copy came off when he was putting this wet cloth on, but the wet cloth produced a version that he could then make into another copy, and that is the copy that you see there. There were 200 of those printed up, one for each of the living signer of the Declaration, one for each of the states, and so forth. And that's the version that most people are familiar with, but that's actually a copy that was made in 1820 from the original. The original is still in the archives. It's very faded. You can barely see anything in it. It's so faded because it was on display for such a long time. It was eventually given over to the Library of Congress, and then the Library of Congress eventually was forced to give it up to the archives, I think it was in 1952, and so it's now on display there. Of the 200 copies of this is called the Stone version, there are probably about 30 of those still exist, and today the archives has taken its original and put it on display for the 4th of July celebration. It has one of the Dunlop copies put on display, and I have given to the archives a copy that I bought, the Stone copy, that put on display today as well. And so those are three of the versions of the Declaration of Independence. Now, many people ignored the Declaration of Independence. As I said, it wasn't after the war was over, many people didn't pay that much attention to it. The key language that I mentioned earlier, the preamble that many people focused on, that did inspire some people. And the person who was probably the most inspired by that of anybody was a man named Abraham Lincoln. Abraham Lincoln grew up in a world where blacks and whites were not treated equally. And I should say Thomas Jefferson, although he early on thought that men were treated equal, he actually had the same view that, Lincoln did, that ultimately, if slavery was ended, blacks should be forced to leave the country. And this was actually Lincoln's view. Lincoln is known as the Great Emancipator, but the truth is that Lincoln's view, which was very typical of those times, and it was really the same view that Jefferson had, it was that blacks should be freed and they should be asked to leave the country. In fact, Lincoln, when he was elected to the Congress of when he served a two-year term, he introduced a bill that said slavery should be ended in the District of Columbia. It should be ended if the citizens of the District of Columbia vote on it. He always believed there should be a vote by people. There should be compensation for the slave owners. And the slaves should be moved to Africa, South America, Central America. And that was his view. He did later in life change his view slightly, but when he became president, he was not intent on freeing the slaves. By a long shot, he was not. Many abolitionists urged him to do so. He said he didn't think that was appropriate because the Constitution of the United States didn't allow him to do so. He thought that the Constitution's spirit was the Declaration of Independence and the sentence that I mentioned. In fact, when he gave his famous Gettysburg Address 67 years ago, our forefathers brought forth on this continent a new nation conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. He believed that all men were created equal. He didn't think they could live together in the United States as equals, but he thought all men were equal. So why did he actually free the slaves? Well, he didn't feel he could do that under the Constitution, but under the war, when the war occurred, he felt ultimately the only way to win the war was to have slavery ended, because he thought the slaves were helping the South so much in producing armaments and other things and in doing all the agricultural work while the soldiers were fighting, that only if slavery ended and the slaves were left to not support the South's war machine would it be possible to win the war. And so he did a very clever thing. Rather than write an eloquent document like the Gettysburg Address, he basically did something very legalistic. He drafted by himself that document, which is the Emancipation Proclamation. And he showed it to his cabinet, and he explained what he was going to do. He was going to use the War Powers Act that he had as commander-in-chief to say that we're at war with the South, and as the commander-in-chief, I'm going to free certain people who live in the South, and those would be the slaves. Now, many people criticized the Emancipation Proclamation because it didn't free slaves in the North. It didn't free slaves in the border states. It only freed states slaves in the southern states, in the parts of the southern states that the North didn't really control. So some people say it only freed really maybe 20,000 slaves. But he was inspired to do so, he said, by the Declaration of Independence statement that all men are created equal. And that was really the driving force behind Lincoln's thought that ultimately slavery should end. Now, when he actually drafted the Emancipation Proclamation, he actually also proposed to Congress legislation that would produce colonization. His view of colonization was that was a word used to they take all the slaves who were freed and move them out of the country. And he actually spent a lot of time looking at places to move the slaves. Hard to believe, but that's what he did, because that was his view. His view was that blacks and whites couldn't live together in a country. So ultimately, he agreed to the Emancipation Proclamation. It probably helped win the war a bit. He was criticized for not going further. And to deal with that criticism, as soon as the war was over and as soon as he was reelected, he pushed for the 13th Amendment. He actually pushed for it to be approved in the lame duck Congress. It was approved. He was assassinated before it actually was ratified by all the states. But ultimately, the 13th Amendment did what the Emancipation Proclamation didn't do. It freed all the slaves. But if you take the Emancipation Proclamation, the Declaration of Independence, and the Magna Carta, they all embody certain freedoms. And the concept that all men are created equal is really underlying all of them. And so I think in this day, the 4th of July, it's very appropriate that we kind of celebrate these documents and recognize the reason we celebrate the 4th of July is not just because the Declaration of Independence, because the freedoms our country has given us. Thank you very much. So,
David,
questions?
There was a term that was used to express Lincoln's policy. There's a term that was used to express Lincoln's policy of relocating slaves to Africa.
That's called a colonization.
No, it's not called that.
Well, that's what I thought it was called. But
I'll go back to my
that's
history.
What I thought it was called. He actually spent a lot of time on that subject, and it was his view that blacks and whites could not live together in our country the way our country was constituted.
There were many supporters of that.
No, that word is...
Yes.
No, that's a different word. That's a word for freeing slaves and letting them live for free in the state. I'm sorry? Yes. Now, actually, this is an interesting point. When Jefferson, when Washington died, he freed all of his slaves. Washington had about 200 slaves. He freed them all. Or actually, he freed them in this way. That's a little complicated. When Washington died, he said that if his wife predeceased him, all the slaves would be freed. She had 200 slaves, he had 200 slaves. If he predeceased, the slaves that he owned would be freed. And in fact, they were freed. The slaves that Martha Washington owned were not freed. When Jefferson died, this is very interesting, he did not free his slaves. He freed six slaves. They were his children by Sally Hemings. As many people know, although he said that blacks and whites couldn't live together, and he had a fairly unfavorable view of blacks in many respects, he had an affair for about 40 years with Sally Hemings, who was actually his wife's half-sister. And he fathered six children with them, and he freed them when he died. He didn't free any of his other slaves. He had about 200 slaves. He didn't free them, and he didn't free Sally Hemings. And people wonder, why did he not free Sally Hemings? He freed her children and his children. The reason was he never acknowledged in his lifetime that he had this affair. He was accused of, while he was president, of having this affair with Sally Hemings. He never acknowledged it. He never denied it. But in Virginia, if you freed a slave, the slave had to leave the state. If the slave was going to stay in the state legislature had to approve it. And Jefferson obviously was afraid that if he freed Sally Hemings and she wanted to stay in the state, that name would go in front of the state legislature, and it would be clear to everybody that it was his mistress. And so that was called manumission, was when you freed a slave and they stayed in the state. Yes, sir.
Well,
but maybe there's another word. I don't know.
Manumission. I can't think of it.
First of all, bravo.
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah.
Thank you. So what was the theory then? If the Emancipation Proclamation was after the war had started,
yes,
what would cause the South to agree to it? So was the theory that they could run to the North, or that at least be free there?
Okay.
And the second part of the question is, remind me, please, what actually started the Civil War? What
okay.
was the triggering?
Well, the Civil War was really started because the Southern states felt that the Northern states were spending too much time overseeing them, and in Fort Sumter, where the war kind of started, the northern troops were there, and the southern states didn't want to have northern troops in their military facilities. They didn't really want to have northern troops in the South, and there were some economic issues, but it was really a fight over whether the North and the Union could control what was going on in the South, and they didn't really want to have all these military troops in the South. In terms of freeing the slaves, if you're a Southern slave owner and Lincoln says, hey, guess what, the slaves are freed, well, you didn't really tell your slaves you're freed. In fact, many slaves did not learn about the Emancipation Proclamation until the war was over, because their slave owners didn't say, hey, guess what, Lincoln just signed this thing and you're free. They didn't do that. They only freed between 20 and 40,000 slaves. Those were slaves who were already in certain areas in the South where the North had kind of controlled those areas, and therefore the slaves were freed, and they were not any longer under control of their slave owners, but they hadn't really left the states. It was only later that the Emancipation Proclamation really freed everybody. So many people criticized Lincoln for not doing more. Abolitionists, by the way, who thought that Lincoln didn't go far enough, even abolitionists were not in favor of having blacks live in the United States. Most abolitionists felt that the slaves should leave the country. Even the most ardent abolitionists were not in favor, for example, of having slaves come to Massachusetts, where many of the abolitionists were. Many of the abolitionists in Boston thought, if the slaves come here, they'll take jobs from whites. And so many abolitionists wanted slavery to be ended, but they actually wanted what I call colonization, or Lincoln called colonization, have the blacks leave. It's hard to believe it, but that's actually was the theory in those days. Yes?
David, I've known you a long time. I'm blown away. I just think you're amazing.
Thank you.
Fantastic. I read 1776,
yes.
And it was a great book. And then and all of a sudden George Washington won, and it was over. But it didn't really say how.
Well,
how did he pull that off?
Well, that's a good thing. A good question. Look, think about this. The war started really, the first shots were fired in April of 1775 at Concord and Lexington. And a couple Americans were killed, and that was for the first time. But actually, April of 1775 was when the first shots were fired. We didn't declare independence until July of 76, over a year later. So for over a year, even though the British troops had shot a number of Americans and killed a number of Americans, Americans didn't really want to be independent. So it took over a year. Now, when the war began in 1776, it wasn't over until 1783. It went on for 7 years. Now, interestingly, in those 7 years, we only lost, quote, only 4,400 Americans were killed, about the same number that have been killed in Iraq, Americans. So in that 7 years, we had about 160,000 Americans had served in the under Washington at various times, and about 230,000 had served in various militias. 230,000 served in militias, 160,000 served under Washington. But any given time, we never had more than 20,000 troops. The British had a standing army of 40,000. They never actually had more than 30,000 in our country at any one time. They had about 30,000 Hessians at one point. We won the war. Actually, Washington won very few battles. He lost most of the battles in the war. And really, if some people say that the reason the Declaration of Independence was drafted and was issued was to get the French on our side, because with the French on our side, we could have much more support. And by the Declaration of Independence, the French could now say, well, we recognize you as an independent country. We're going to give you supplies. We're going to give you naval help. We're going to do other things against England. And without the French help, honestly, as much as we might hate to admit it, we probably wouldn't have won the war. And so Washington was helped by a lot of the French support, the French naval armaments. But Washington lost more battles than he won. And many times it was discussed of replacing Washington. Washington served for free. Now, this is a good lesson for everybody. Washington said, I want to serve my country for free. Just pay my expenses. Well, when somebody says just pay your expenses, pay him a salary. Because it was millions of dollars. The Civil War, the Revolutionary War cost America about $170 million. That was paid by taxes and so forth. Ultimately, when the war was over, we had $27 million of debt. And that was a lot of money to pay off. And you know, ever since that time, the United States, except for 1834 and 1835, the United States has been in debt since the Revolutionary War. So, and we started with $27 million. Today we have about $70 trillion, but that's another matter. Yes?
Okay.
Because, of course, a lot of the great revolutionary figures were mercenaries and others who came, not just the French, but came out of ideological convictions and support. Could you tell us about that process?
Okay. Jefferson was very familiar with the Enlightenment thinkers. In fact, he was most influenced by a person named John Locke, famous Swiss philosopher. And many people say that much of the Declaration of Independence really came from Locke's ideas. Some people say it came from an Irish philosopher, Hutchison. But whatever the case, the ideas that Jefferson put in his Declaration of Independence were fairly common ideas, that you had certain rights. These were rights that were given by God, in effect. And when Jefferson wrote the Declaration of Independence and it was sent and ultimately to England, people there were didn't really pay attention to the language as much. The idea that the preamble, nobody paid attention to that. They only paid attention. There were three parts of the Declaration of Independence: the preamble, the poetic language that I mentioned, all the things that King George didn't read wrong, and at the end it said, and we're breaking away. And that was the thing that people paid attention to. People in England were outraged a bit because they thought the colonies were disloyal. These were people they had created. You know, any of you who have children know what it's like. You create a child, and then when they become a teenager or a young adult, they don't listen to you so much. Well, maybe it was the same thing here. So England was outraged. But in those days, England went on to do quite well without the colonies. The colonies had not made England wealthy. The colonies were a bit of a financial drag on England. That's why they were imposing taxes. And England was the richest country in the world, and they survived quite well without the colonies for a while. I think in the end, many people didn't really think we would win the war. Some people in our country thought we were going to lose for sure. And there were many Tories, so-called loyalists in our country, who were really hoping we would lose. And there were about 50,000 identified Tories. In fact, many people who actually signed the Declaration of Independence were were treated very poorly by people in their states because they thought that they had been disloyal to the country, and many of them actually were tortured or in other ways in prisons in some cases. Two people signed the Declaration of Independence became presidents of the United States, Thomas Jefferson and John Adams. And as many people know from the stories that have come out recently, they had a bitter feud. They were very close for a while. Jefferson was viewed as Adams' younger brother by Adams, but then they had a bitter feud, and they didn't talk for 11 years. And then eventually they came together, and as everybody I think knows, they died together on July. They died on the same day, on July the 4th, I think it was 1826, 50 years to the day of the Declaration of Independence being agreed to. Madeline?
I have to stand up to say this. As somebody who had Thomas Jefferson's job. I want to say I spent July 4th, 2000 at Monticello with giving naturalization certificates to a whole new group of Americans in a very important place. And here we are on July 4th, and we have a new American president who is an African American, and I think we should celebrate that. But I also think, David, we have a great deal to thank you for, because you have not only given us a brilliant speech and blown me away, David and I worked together in the Carter administration, but what you have done in giving this to our country is beyond measure.
Thank you so much. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thanks very much. Thank you. Thank you all. Now it's time to go here. Alan, one more question.
David, you're just following on Madeline's point. Here we are in 2009, 4th of July, we have an African-American president.
Right.
Women can vote, they couldn't vote at the time. Put yourself in the position of the founding fathers coming back all this period later, and what would they have thought? How would this country, as it turned out, been different from what they envisaged it to be? Put yourself in that position.
Remember, they actually didn't think they were creating a new country. They were freeing themselves from the British, that there were going to be 13 separate colonies, and they would conduct their own affairs, and maybe they'd come together loosely like they did in the Articles of Confederation. One interesting thing, Abigail Adams wrote to John Adams when he was going to the Continental Congress. She said, "Don't forget the ladies." In other words, give us some rights. But it didn't say in the preamble anything about women. It wasn't discussed. Yes, sir.
How controversial do you think the Constitutional Convention was several years later in terms of what would have happened if it failed, if they could not have reached...
If they had not
been able to reach an agreement on the Constitution, which was a very difficult process.
Right. The Constitution was much more complicated. And interestingly, we know about the debate and what everybody said in the Constitutional Convention because James Madison kept extraordinary notes. Nobody really kept any notes about the Declaration of Independence deliberations. We don't really know exactly what people said. Jefferson took a little bit of notes. The Articles of Confederation, which were agreed to, didn't work, as you know, because the country was thought to be too weak. Had we not agreed to the Constitution and had a system, I don't know what would have happened. I suspect the country would not be where it is today. Or suppose the South had won the war. You know, Lincoln thought for many years the South probably was going to win the war. And it was not a given that the South was going to lose. In fact, Lincoln refused to give the Emancipation Proclamation until he thought the North was likely to win, and it wasn't until 1863 that he actually issued it. Yes, sir.
A little known fact about the Emancipation Proclamation is that during the Civil War, the South actually contemplated very seriously about freeing the slaves as well, and they thought that the institution of slavery was going to die in any event, but also as a means of being able to perpetuate the war. And during the Civil War, the South was actually more integrated in its regiments than the North ever was. But my question goes back to during the Revolutionary War, were there any states that kind of weren't any colonies that were not carrying their own weight in the war? Like, say, we're just not doing this. We're not interested. We're reluctant.
Well, I would say Georgia was probably a state that wasn't exactly as involved as some of the other states. They were probably contributed less. I think Massachusetts and Virginia were probably the states that were the most actively involved. In New York, at one point, as I mentioned, they abstained on the initial vote for the Declaration of Independence. They were diffident about it a bit. And Pennsylvania was uncertain. In fact, Pennsylvania led the effort against the Declaration of Independence. And finally, the man who was against the Declaration of Independence, seeing where the vote was going to go, walked out of the Constitutional Convention, walked out of the Congress so that his Pennsylvania state could vote for it without his having to be there present for it, a man named John Dickinson. But I'd say Georgia probably, without any disrespect to Georgia, probably was the least of the 13 that probably contributed the most during the war, be my guess. One more question because we have to go. Yes?
I just wanted to say, if anybody hasn't read it, you should read Founding Mothers by Cokie Roberts for that other perspective about what the women were doing back then.
All right. Well, thank you all very much. Thank you.